From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York today.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, pushed back against acting Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke's claim yesterday that hurricane recovery in Puerto Rico is a good news story. Here's San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz on CNN Today.
When you're drinking from a creek, it's not a good news story. When you don't have food for a baby, it's not a good news story. When you have to pull people down from their buildings, because, you know, I'm sorry, but that really upsets me and frustrates me.
And she went on to say, it's a people are dying news story.
In tweets last night and this morning, President Trump defended his administration's Puerto Rico response. He wrote, wish press would treat fairly, and big decisions will have to be made as to the cost of rebuilding Puerto Rico. Let's bring in our politics roundtable. Joining us today, Tolu Olorunipa, who is a White House reporter for Bloomberg News. Hi, Tolu.
Hello. How are you?
Doing well. And Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Jeremy.
And Ron, let me start with you. What do you make of the Trump administration's response to Puerto Rico? There are still a lot of people in dire straits there more than a week after the storm hit.
First of all, we should say this was a terrible hurricane, and it was far worse than anything that has hit directly on the island in many, many years, decades. So there was probably a disbelief that it could be this bad, and that obviously affected the preparation on all levels. But the big contrast here between what's been done for Puerto Rico and what was done for Texas and Florida is rankling, not only to the people of Puerto Rico, but to fair-minded people anywhere, to look and see and ask, did the administration do everything that it had done for American citizens in Florida and Texas, in Puerto Rico, where they are American citizens? Perhaps we should all reflect on the reluctance of some people in this country to realize that.
Well, and Tolu, the Washington Post did another contrast. They concluded that the response to the earthquake in Haiti was much faster than the response to Puerto Rico. 2 days is how fast it was, even though there was no warning of the earthquake, as there was a warning with Maria that this was going to slam Puerto Rico. Thousands more U.S. troops went to Haiti, although the Post did point out there are legal restrictions to sending troops into a U.S. territory as opposed to a foreign country. But more to the point, the president didn't show leadership, talking about football players while on that, you know, that deadly split screen that lawmakers have to watch out for. The CNN was showing the devastation in Puerto Rico. Your thoughts on what he said in the days after the hurricane?
Yeah, it definitely looked like the president, his mind was not on Puerto Rico over the weekend. As the worst of this situation was starting to play out, the president's mind appeared to be on culture wars over the NFL, over the national anthem. And the president, when he finally got around to sort of commenting on this week, he said, you know, Puerto Rico is different from Florida and Texas, where he did show a little bit more focus, saying that basically it's in the middle of an ocean, it's an island, and it's hard to get assets over there. And I think that article sort of pointing out the difference between the Haiti earthquake sort of undercuts that argument. We do have assets. Puerto Rico is part of the United States, and we do have the ability to get over there. And the fact that, the rhetoric we're hearing from the president now is that Puerto Rico was already in a lot of trouble before the hurricane hit. Their electrical grid was struggling. They're, you know, suffering from debt. So it's definitely a different approach than what we saw during hurricanes earlier this year with Texas and Florida. And people are wondering why the difference. And that's a question that the White House has not yet fully answered.
Well, the president's mind may have been on what just happened in Alabama, too, this week. Former Ten Commandments Judge Roy Moore sending a shockwave through the Republican Party by winning that runoff election to fill Jeff Sessions' Senate seat. Here's former Trump chief strategist Steve Bannon campaigning for Moore this week.
And you're going to see in state after state after state, people that follow the model of Judge Moore, that do not need to raise money from the elites, from the crony capitalists, from the fat cats in Washington, D.C., New York City, Silicon Valley.
Ron, was this a watershed moment? And given the things that Roy Moore has said in the past, lock up homosexuals, saying there are communities in the U.S. living under Sharia law, are Republicans going to be afraid to get too close to him?
Yes, many are going to pedal away from him as quickly as they pedaled away from Todd Akin in Missouri a few years ago, who was saying embarrassing things with regard to women's biology. And many Republicans were making it clear they did not want any part of that particular Republican nominee for the Senate, and he did lose. So we will see probably some of that behavior again with Judge Roy Moore. It's hard not to call him that, even though he's already been removed twice from the Alabama State Supreme Court. People still call him that as though he had three names. This was called a political earthquake, but in many respects, it was more like a political hurricane because in this case, there was definitely warning. We knew weeks ago that Roy Moore was running ahead of the Republican field, that he was likely to win, that he was likely to win this runoff. And the Republican Party's response was just to pour in more money, send Donald Trump down there, the president of the United States, endorsing Luther Strange, but also sending signals at the same time that he wouldn't mind having Roy Moore win the primary and that he would endorse him if he did.
So NPR's Ron Elving there and Tolu Olorunipa from Bloomberg News helping us look at the past week. And I want to ask, at the end of the week, Tolu, do we know where we are on health care reform? The Republicans announced they didn't have the votes to vote on their plan, and everybody thought, there, that is it, the nail in the coffin. And then President Trump says, oh, no, it's just because somebody was not well and we didn't have our yes votes, and so we're going to do it again.
That's right. It's a major question about whether or not the president is in denial about this health care reform effort. He is the only one sort of touting this line that, oh, we have the votes. It's just because someone was in the hospital. The White House press secretary was asked about this because everyone wanted to know which senator was in the hospital. And it turns out there is no senator in the hospital. This is Thad Cochran of Mississippi, who is a yes vote. He has been having some health problems, but he's recovering at home. And his vote would not change the balance of the health care situation. There are three senators that have come out publicly against the health care bill. And those were three different senators who, whether or not Thad Cochran was there or not, would vote against the bill, and the bill would have failed if it had come up. But I think the broader message is that the White House and Republicans are saying that they're not giving up on this effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. They are going to try to put together the votes. They're going to try to turn some of those no votes into yes votes over the next few months, and early in 2018, they're going to take another shot at this strategy of trying to fulfill this campaign.
Just to follow up, though, the open enrollment for Obamacare is November 1st.
Yeah, and it does not appear that President Trump and his administration are going to try to comply with the current law and make sure that the law is upheld and that it moves forward. They're trying to undermine it with the hopes that it implodes, and then next year they can come and get more support for their alternative. Open enrollment is about to start, and the Trump administration is taking money away from advertising, taking money away from the various programs that help people get enrolled and help people know about healthcare, the healthcare markets. So it will be very interesting to see whether or not Congress pushes back on that. We've heard some talks about a bipartisan effort to shore up the current Affordable Care Act markets. And if that passes, it will be very interesting to see whether or not President Trump sort of accepts this as a law of the land or vetoes that and tries to continue to undermine Obamacare with the hopes that very soon he will get to fulfill his promise of repealing and replacing it.
I have to ask about airplane gate. Tom Price, the Health and Human Services Secretary, just one of the cabinet officials under fire for taking private planes or government planes at a huge taxpayer expense. The president says he is not happy about it. And Secretary Price went on Fox News to explain and say he's reimbursing the government for the cost of his seat on the flights. Let's listen.
We've heard the concerns. I've heard the concerns. I've heard the criticisms. And in order to make certain that people appreciate that my respect for the taxpayer is as strong as it can be and always has been in my 40-year career, we think it's important to do a number of things. One is to say there will be no private air charters at HHS going forward.
Ron, it seems to me that this, combined with the Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke and EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt also doing travel on these kinds of jets, as well as Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, it really steps on President Trump's message that he's trying to drain the swamp and be for the little guy.
It is not exactly a populist airline that they're riding on. They're riding on military planes, in Tom Price's case, to the tune of something like $500,000. All of his travel on charters, private charters, adding up to another $500,000, something like $1 million in questionable air flights just since May. He's also been flying members of his family around and some of these other people in the Trump administration as well, all of whom are well known over the course of their careers as people who want to squeeze a government dollar. But now that they are in the administration, in the cabinet, they feel that there is a necessity for them to be on super secure planes with super secure communications, even if that means taking a $25,000 charter from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, when they could get a train ticket for under $100.
If the call is that important, just stay on the ground for another hour. That's what I would say.
That would be an alternative.
Well, that's Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. We've also been speaking with Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for Bloomberg News, about this week that was. And guess what? There's another one around the corner. So, gentlemen, thank you both, and touch back with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
And it's been a tumultuous week. Puerto Rico still suffering terribly from the effects of Hurricane Maria. The latest health care initiative failed to pass. Fans attending football games found themselves in the middle of a spat between the NFL and the President of the United States. So let's end the week with a visit to the opera. That's Ryan Speedo Green. Speedo because his dad loved Speedos, the swimsuit. And now Speedo is the young African-American baritone bass who's made quite a splash in opera. Last year, the New York Times called his performance as Kalina in Puccini's La Boheme at New York's famed Metropolitan Opera show-stopping. It was a long journey to this stage. His parents were violent. When Speedo was 4, his dad left. His mom became more abusive. When he was 12, Speedo lashed back, pulling a knife on her, which landed him in solitary confinement in a brutal juvenile detention center. But then a combination of teachers steered him to the Governor's Magnet School for the Arts in Roanoke, Virginia, which made a fateful field trip to the Met. Much later, he was accepted into the Met's elite Lindemann Young Artist Development Program. What a story. And journalist Daniel Bergner tells it in the book Sing for Your Life, A Story of Race, Music, and Family, now out in paperback.
Hello.
This is Ryan.
Hi, I'm Speedo.
Oh, that voice.
Hey, I'm Daniel.
Nice to meet you.
Boy, what a
We visited with writer Daniel Bergner and opera star Speedo Green at the Met in New York last fall. As we walked the halls, I asked Speedo about his first fateful visit. Well, let's talk about that. We can walk down this red velvet. I feel like I'm inside a jewelry box here. Talk about when you first came.
Yes, so at the age of 15, I went on a school field trip with my Magnet School for the Arts, and this is my first time singing opera. And the opera was Carmen. The lead character was played by an African-American mezzo-soprano by the name of Denise Graves. And for a 15-year-old me, who thought opera was something only a white person could do, was something that I never thought I would see a person who looks like me, who has the same color as me, on stage doing. It made it tangible. And she was amazing. She made me feel every emotion I could feel. And afterwards, I got to meet her.
She hugged you.
So it's almost like it should be, like it's almost, for me, movie-like. I walked outside and I was with my chorus teacher, Robert Brown, and I told him, you know, Mr. Brown, I want to sing at the Met. That's what I want to do. And it was the first real dream that I ever had. And less than 9 years, 9 years later, I was singing at the Metropolitan Opera.
We walked past practice rooms and corridors piled high with costumes and sheet music, the same corridors Speedo paced those 9 years later when, as a 24-year-old, after studying in college, he competed in the Metropolitan Opera's National Council auditions, a portal to professional success. Here he is in the finals. Speedo was one of the winners, and there that day, journalist Daniel Bergner. What did you see?
I saw a radiant human being. I was slowly
hearing a story about transformation, about the power of will.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, Speedo. Go back to when you were a kid, terrible childhood that I understand you're not always comfortable talking about, but lots of violence. You've said that when you see the documents that Daniel got after you were taken away to a facility after you drew a knife on your mom, you don't even recognize that person.
No, I didn't. The person that I am today is a completely different person than I was back then. I think one of the first things I did when I got out of the detention center was to put everything behind me. If I didn't do that, I wouldn't have been able to move forward and take up the task that I did after I got out.
There were a couple of very inspiring teachers who refused to give up on Speedo. And
Mr. and Mrs. Hughes come to mind.
And Mr. Brown. And then just a tremendous amount of determination.
Well, talk about along the way, though. Let's talk about the sound, because a lot of people think, oh, and it was discovered when he was 12 that he opened his mouth and out came angels. It didn't happen that way.
No.
It's funny. I went back to the School for the Arts where he was almost thrown out after his first year because he had no ability to read music and no particular promise. And I said, what's the truth? And the director of the vocal program said, listen, he could not sing. You were not hearing then what anything like what you're hearing now.
Ultimately, the voice that we hear now started to appear, but when it first did, Speedo had to learn how to use it, train like an athlete, like a surgeon. And he was surrounded by other singers who'd been singing and training their whole young lives in multiple languages.
Despite preconceptions, I did not grow up singing in the church, nor was I a prodigy by any means. I dreamed of being an opera singer before I had the tools.
Well, and it's just no guarantee. All these many coaches are hoping. I'm reading one coach say, you were born with a trombone and you had to work to get a little more of a trumpet. You had to figure out how to sing 30 pitches on approximately 20 vowels, 600 combinations.
Yeah. That alone, you know, is daunting for a person who went a lot on gut. It took almost a year with maybe two or three voice lessons a week just to be able to implement it.
You know, the fact that Americans, we get lazy in our speech, so we say absolutely, sa. It's really absolutely. But when you're singing in Italian and you do that same thing in Italian, the entire audience might cringe.
And not only will the audience cringe, but my colleagues on stage or maybe the conductor, who is most likely Italian, will give me a look. Luckily, I know enough to be able to get by these rehearsals,
yeah,
but it's definitely a growing experience.
Well, but when this is happening, luckily you're you, because you made a decision to admit that you hadn't been studying since you were 13. And so there's these poignant moments, people working so hard with you, and someone says, well, make it more melancholy. And you say, I don't know what that is.
You know, I made a conscious decision to not let any of this go to waste. Maybe someone might look at me weird to be like, oh, how could you not know what melancholy means? But for me, like the moment that they tell me, I'll know. Whatever. Yeah, I'm sorry. I literally can't think.
You're done.
Yeah.
Sorry.
On this day, Speedo is tired. But as we mentioned, he also has trouble at times talking about the traumatic moments in his past. After he left for an audition, we asked Daniel about that.
One of the realizations I had was that people in my world assume that digging deep into the past is going to liberate us and make us better people, more functional people. That was not Speedo's assumption. He really needed, when he got out of that facility, and remember, he was taken there not only in handcuffs but in leg shackles. This was a really violent moment in his life. And when he got out of there, his impulse was close the door on the past. And in lots of ways, of course, he was right.
Did you ever think, wow, what if he doesn't have an opera voice?
I think this is a key point. There was so much doubt.
And then when he did develop the voice, how heartbreaking to hear. He's now singing the finest opera arias, and everyone, you know, at fundraising events wants him to sing Old Man River.
Right. So from the very beginning, Speedo has faced the challenges of race from all directions. Of course, his black friends in high school taunted him for singing white music. the same time, ever since he started singing classically, white audience members have come up afterward and said, oh, you should really just sing like Paul Robeson and sing Old Man River. And this haunts him to this day. Old Man River is a wonderful song, but it is sung by a black character who's all but a slave in the Jim Crow South and who longs for death as the only release from the chains that he symbolically wears. And this is the great thing about Speedo's story to me, is it's all about trying to break out of boxes. The box that he was put in as a 12-year-old when he was locked up in an institution, and the box that race puts him in terms of identity. All his life, he's been trying to expand the boundaries of his identity. And the request to sing Old Man River, even though it's beautiful, and believe me, he can sing it beautifully, are an attempt in the end to put him back inside a box.
As we said goodbye, Speedo told us about his recent visit to one of those boxes.
I was able to go back to the detention facility. And once I got over the trauma of seeing my cell and the solitary confinement where I spent a lot of time in, I was able to sing and speak to the kids. And I told them that I had once been where they were sitting, and they couldn't believe it. And one of the kids asked me, like, so that means I could go to college? That was huge. And, you know, there were some kids there who tried to spit on me as I was singing. Even that, I tried to connect with them, tried to sing to them as if he were part of the aria. One of the kids said he was a rapper, and, you know, he had this sort of overly tough persona, reminded me of myself when I was his age. And I realized that a lot of the reasons why I was so angry and I was so had so many eruptions and I was so violent was because maybe I couldn't accept kindness from others, and maybe I just didn't like the person that I was. It was such an honor for them to open up to me.
Ryan Speedo Green and the rest of the cast of La Boheme performing at the Metropolitan Opera last year. Daniel Bergner's book about Speedo Green, Sing for Your Life, is now out in paperback. You're listening to Here and Now. On Wednesday, a British climber was killed and his wife seriously injured when a rock said to be the size of an apartment building fell. Yesterday, another slab of granite, witnesses said, was 10 times bigger than Wednesday's, tumbled off the famous El Capitan rock formation, hitting a car and injuring an elderly man inside. Here's how two witnesses described it to the BBC.
It sounded like thunder. And she looked back and she said,
I said, there's smoke coming out of the mountain.
Andrea Lankford is a former park ranger at Yosemite and author of the book Ranger Confidential, Living, Working, and Dying in the National Parks. Andrea, two rock slides in Yosemite in 1 week. Do these things happen and we just don't know about it?
Well, it's estimated that Yosemite sees at least 80 rock falls a year. Mm. Now, this is a very dynamic geology in Yosemite Valley. And what makes it beautiful is also what makes it dangerous.
Yeah, and El Capitan, one of the most iconic sites in any national park, and one that attracts climbers. Are you surprised more people weren't killed or injured?
On El Capitan, not so much, because the climbers are scattered all over that rock wall. And for better or worse, that was a rock slide that occurred in a more remote area away from the cabins and hotels.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if it's reminding you of other times when you were a ranger at Yosemite. You were part of a search and rescue mission after another deadly rock slide at Yosemite Valley's Happy Isles in 1996. And just, you know, a little bit of your thoughts about that. I'm imagining you might have been thinking about that.
Yeah, I was called in to help handle the aftermath of that rock slide. It was a very tragic event. 162,000 tons of rock came off of the 3,000-foot rock wall above Happy Isles, and this caused a hurricane-force wind at 160 miles per hour, which knocked down trees. Interestingly, it was not the rocks that killed the camper. It was trees that fell from that wind blast.
Huh. Well, the National Park Service issued a statement agreeing with you. This is, you know, common. Many go unreported. There have now been 16 fatalities and more than 100 injuries from rock falls, but since park records began in 1857. So this is still a very safe place to be as far as rock slides.
Yeah, these are rare occurrences. It's, you know, like a lightning strike. The Park Service does studies. And they, in 2008, they did a study, and they moved 72 structures out of what they felt was a vulnerable area.
Is there anything that people can do? I mean, is there something you should be aware of? Should a sound you should listen for? Is there anything you can do to protect yourself?
Yeah, these events always break my heart as a national park ranger when somebody gets hurt.
Yeah.
But there are things you can do. You know, if you hear strange noises, if you feel a vibration, during transition seasons like fall to winter, that heat stress, those are times to be more alert with the rock slides.
Yeah.
They do say that if you hear rocks falling, get behind the biggest, strongest rock that you can find as the debris falls down, and that might protect you.
Yeah, because what's behind those pebbles might be something much bigger.
Yeah.
Andrea Langford, former park ranger at Yosemite National Park, author of the book Ranger Confidential, Living, Working, Dying in the National Parks. Andrea, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And I'm in New York City today. We're just a few blocks from our studios in Midtown. There's a new real estate development, the biggest private development in the history of America. It's called Hudson Yards. And when it's finished, it'll include 16 new skyscrapers on the west side of Manhattan. Joining us now for our View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders, is Jeff Blau, CEO of Related Companies, which is behind the project. Jeff Blau, welcome. And tell us about Hudson Yards.
We now own about 28 acres of land and have development rights for about 20 million square feet of development of office, retail, residential, hotel, schools, parks, cultural facilities. It's really a whole city unto itself.
Just 5 years ago or so, it was train tracks over there.
So we built all of this over – these are the Long Island Railroad trains that come in every day. They drop it at Penn Station and they continue moving slowly. And these are storage sheds. So the trains sit there during the day. They get cleaned and cooled and then they go back out in the afternoon. So it, in addition to kind of the economic challenge of building all this at once, the physical and engineering challenges were pretty terrific.
Where is all the money coming from for this?
So we, you know, this is obviously a private development. In total, it'll be about $25 billion of investment into New York City. We're a private company, so we bring in capital partners from around the world, U.S. Pension funds, foreign sovereign wealth funds, and traditional construction lenders.
But there's a, for example, a $32 million penthouse in Hudson Yards. Who's going to do that? Is that foreign investors or are those people in the United States?
Who's going to buy that?
Who's going to buy that?
Yeah. So we started selling our first residential building about 8-9 months ago. It's 15 Hudson Yards. It's one of our tallest towers with incredible views of the river. We've sold about $650 million of condos since last October. And I think that makes it one of the fastest selling condos ever in New York. So the buyer profile is really primarily domestic buyers, a lot of New Yorkers. Interestingly, a lot of people around New York City, so New Jersey, Westchester, Long Island, homeowners who want a place in the city. And I think everyone's really attracted to kind of the retail that's going to be there, 20 different restaurants. A lot of the buyers are people that whose companies have or are planning to relocate there. And so, you know, the West Chelsea neighborhood just attached to Hudson Yards has become the fastest growing residential neighborhood in New York City. So it's people that want to be there. They're, you know, the art galleries and the Whitney Museum and the High Line and kind of all the great things happening combined with what is about to happen is really kind of what's attracting people.
How do you avoid what happened at the World Trade Center when some of the new buildings went up there and some of them are still empty to a large degree?
Well, for the most part, our buildings are leased. So it's already – we've passed that state. Of the four office buildings, we've leased 3.5 of them.
Why do you think that is though? Why did you succeed where they failed?
I don't know that they failed, first of all. But I think, you know, from our perspective, I think, you know, Hudson Yards is really attached to Midtown. It is part of the city, part of Midtown here where people want to be. And I think, you know, what Bloomberg did in kind of rezoning the West Side and rezoning Hudson Yards, it was really to ensure that New York City stayed competitive on the global scale. CEOs are looking for an environment. CEOs are looking for a way to use real estate as a talent attraction and retention tool. And so you can't just build great buildings. You have to have all the other parts around it.
Some of our listeners will hear you talk about all this and say, we must be in a bubble if people are spending this kind of money on this kind of real estate. Are you worried at all about a collapse? It's happened in the past. It's going to happen at some point in the future.
Yeah, not really. I mean, I think, look, New York is the greatest city in the world, right? And we have diversified our economy pretty well over the past couple of decades beyond just the financial services that it has been. And, you know, yes, the $32 million penthouse is an expensive apartment, and it is actually an exception to kind of our typical pricing because it's obviously the best unit on the top. But if you look at kind of where we've priced things, I mean, we – Hudson Yards is not has not been positioned to be like the 57th Street hyper expensive apartments that are only for, you know, the foreign wealthy chic that comes here.
There's a pencil-thin tall building on 57th Street is what you're talking about.
Correct. And it's not – and that's not what Hudson Yards is about. This Hudson Yards is built for New Yorkers. It's built for domestic buyers. People are going to live here. These aren't investors where, you know, at nighttime this is going to be a dark building and you're not going to see any activity. Yes, obviously this is – these any new building for the most part is more expensive than some of the older product and may only be affordable to a small segment of the market. But this is not – we're not dependent upon the wealthy billionaire who comes here from, you know, another country. We're building for New York.
Where else in the country do you see a market as hot as New York right now, or are there any?
I mean, across the United States, New York is by far the strongest market. I think San Francisco obviously is very, very strong right now. And what's driving a lot of that in both of those cities are tech jobs, right, and technology companies. And so if you look at the job creation in that sector, and again, as I said, the diversification beyond financial services, that's what's really kind of driving this economy. And if you look at other cities, you know, I think anyone that really wants to grow is really going to have to attract those type of companies because that's really the future.
So if there was a downturn in tech, that would be a problem for you?
Again, I think New York City is diversified, but look, I think that's – it would probably slow the pace of growth. I mean, look at what's happening today with the Amazon bid that's been announced. They've have every city in the country competing for probably the most exciting opportunity for a city and for a private developer ever, right? I mean, they're talking about moving 50,000 people,
right?
Incredible jobs, right, that any city would love to have, 8 million square feet of development. It's an incredible opportunity for some city. And, you know, I think that's where, you know, as New York City needs to, if they want to stay competitive, they have to continue to be able to attract those type of companies here.
But there are already people with this Amazon contest going on who are saying, I don't want that in my city because it's just going to drive up the cost of living for everybody else. I'm sure you hear that about your own projects. What do you say to those people who say, this is going to make my life worse and I'm not going to benefit from this?
I think that's short-sighted. I really do. I think bringing 50,000 high-paying jobs to a city is really what keeps cities young and growing and attractive. And I think any city that's lucky enough to have Amazon would be incredibly lucky.
Hudson Yards is along the Hudson River. How much do you think about climate change?
We think about it quite a bit. Obviously, we've had an incredible, unfortunate year, you know.
The hurricanes.
The hurricanes. And who knows whether those things are related, but it seems like those 500-year events are happening, you know, more frequently than every 500 years these days. And so you can't ignore it, especially in our business, because we're building physical structures. We're on an island. You know, we had felt the impact of Sandy in some of our buildings, and you know, we had lessons learned. And so today, I mean, Hudson Yards is very different in the sense that we're building over these train tracks, and so everything is elevated by definition. I mean, we don't directly have that issue at Hudson Yards, but as a developer throughout New York City, we think about this all the time. And you know, we have done things like moved our mechanical systems up out of the basements. We've put flood barriers around buildings. We really study where that 500-year floodplain is and make sure we don't have any systems, critical systems below that point.
Finally, I just want to ask you, since you are a real estate developer here in New York, what is it like to have a real estate developer from New York in the White House? Or what do you think of President Trump so far?
We've all known President Trump for a long time through the real estate business, and it's interesting to see him now running the country. Look, I think he's got some ambitious ideas and goals. You see the tax plan that he thinks he's going to get done, and some of it is good. I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of chaos around kind of daily events that get in the way of productive things getting done. And so,
is any of that having an impact on your business or no?
Not really, day in and day out. I mean, as a citizen of the United States, we worry about it, if you're asking. But in terms of our day in and day out business, not quite as much. I think, you know, some of the things around the tax bill changes and state and local deductibility could have a pretty big impact on New York City. I mean, we're a high tax state, and that deduction is very valuable. But we haven't seen – that hasn't happened yet.
That's Jeff Blau, the CEO of Related Companies. Thank you so much for coming in.
Good being here. Thank you.
And we'll post some photos of Hudson Yards at hereandnow.org.
While many people are still struggling in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, life has returned to normal for much of the city of Houston. Damaged parts of the city are being rebuilt, and many residents are hoping for some improvements, like making this car-friendly city safer for bicyclists and pedestrians. Cycling and pedestrian fatalities have been climbing, along with close calls, incidents where people are almost hit. And researchers in Houston are trying to figure out just how often these near misses happen and why. Gail DeLauter from Houston Public Media reports.
A lot of people remember May 25th, 2015 as the day the big Memorial Day flood hit Houston. MT Philly remembers it as a day she was almost hit while riding her bike. It was at a busy intersection in the Museum District.
I was nearly struck head-on by a vehicle who chose to just ignore or blow through or whatever his story was on a left-turn yield flashing yellow arrow.
Philly was headed downtown to work before the rains came.
I came off where that Ford truck was, and as I rolled to the first lane that compresses tight, he hit the gas and nearly slammed into me. I almost went over his hood.
Philly was lucky that day not to become a statistic. So far this year in Houston, at least 5 people have been killed on bikes. At least 40 pedestrians have been struck and killed. But when it comes to near misses, incidents that didn't result in a crash, that's a lot harder to measure.
You could be talking about 5, 6, 7, maybe even 10,000 close calls a day.
We're in front of the Central Police Station with Captain William McPherson, the head of the Houston Police Department's Vehicular Crimes Division. McPherson says officers can give tickets for near collisions if they determine the driver's at fault. They can also ticket drivers for passing too close to cyclists. But he admits it's not always easy.
Basically, it's very simple. The officer has to witness it. Officer has to see the infraction.
These are incidents that are often missed in data points. People experience them in their daily travel, and then they are not recorded.
That's Kyle Sheldon with Rice University's Kinder Institute to try to get a handle on the number of close calls. The Institute did a study to see how often those near misses actually happen. So Kinder recruited 187 volunteers. They kept a journal of their daily travels by foot or by bike. They also provided information about their close calls. Sheldon's colleague, Dan Notikasari, says a team looked for recurring themes, not just where those incidents happened, but how the person felt afterward.
It gives a finer details of understanding on how people travel and how they, you know, what encourages or discourages them from actually going out there on the streets.
And the confidence people have about walking or riding. That's a major issue as the city tries to encourage people to get out of their cars. Traffic engineer Robert Benz of the Texas A&M Transportation Institute says street design can go a long way in helping walkers and cyclists feel safe. But to avoid close calls, it's a matter of everyone simply paying attention.
Everybody has to do their part and follow the rules, stopping at stop signs, obeying the speed limit, so on and so forth. And we see it every day that people do not do that.
Ricky Carroll can attest to that. He's a geophysicist at an oil and gas firm, and he bicycles around downtown quite a bit. Carroll says most of his trips are uneventful. but not the day he encountered a driver in a place where he wasn't supposed to be, the green painted bike lane. Carroll says a car was coming straight toward him.
I mean, it's like, well, what are you doing? I yell at him, and he just kept on coming. I finally pulled it aside, and he just brushed right by me. You know, I like tapped his car and said, hey, you know, you're in the bike lane. But he didn't seem to care. He stopped at the light and continued driving.
When the week-long study was finished, researchers had reports of more than 130 near misses. The majority of close calls involve cars and bicycles, incidents like passing too closely or turning in front of a cyclist. But why are these close calls happening in the first place? Kyle Sheldon with Rice University's Kinder Institute says one big reason is distracted driving, like people on their smartphones. Another cause, the roads themselves. Sheldon says streets were built for cars. And that leads to what he calls a hierarchy of relationships that makes walkers and cyclists feel marginalized.
And when we're seeing stuff like they're feeling like they have to be prepared for an incident at any point, or they're feeling like they are being ignored by drivers, or that it's just kind of an unsafe place in a lot of ways, that's a really important message for us as Houstonians to hear.
Back in the Museum District, cyclist MT Philly says if Houston doesn't improve its attitude about street safety, young people who want to live without a car might not stick around.
There's a different cost of living and a different attitude somewhere else. And if the youth market doesn't feel like this is a place where they can settle down, pursue a career, start something, they'll leave.
But to prevent that from happening, Houston has been working on some initiatives to make things safer. For one, the police department has announced sting operations, where officers will go after drivers who pass too close to cyclists. For Here and Now, I'm Gail DeLauder in Houston.